off to the races on IAS 12. Thomas?
Thank you, Wayne. Good morning. At its meeting in January 2014, the IFRS Interpretations Committee asked the staff to draft an amendment to IAS 12 that would clarify the accounting for deferred tax assets for unrealized losses on debt instruments measured at fair value. Subject to reviewing the draft amendment to IAS 12, the Interpretations Committee supported the staff recommendation that such an amendment to IAS 12 should mainly be an illustrative example, with other amendments to IAS 12 only made if the clarification through an illustrative example is insufficient. The Interpretations Committee also asked the staff to assess, when drafting the amendment to IAS 12, whether the proposed amendment might cause any unintended consequences for the accounting for deferred tax arising in relation to non-financial assets measured at fair value. We drafted an amendment to IAS 12 that is included in staff paper 2A for this meeting on the basis of the requirements that the Interpretations Committee had laid down at its meeting in January 2014. The amendments consist of a draft illustrative example and two proposed clarifications to paragraph 29 of IAS 12. The first clarification to paragraph 29 of IAS 12 is to explain the difference between taxable profit that is defined in paragraph 5 of IAS 12 and the taxable profit that is used to assess the utilization of deductible temporary differences. In particular, the later one excludes tax deductions resulting from the reversal of deductible temporary differences. The other clarification to paragraph 29 is that it explains that an entity assumes to recover an asset for more than its carrying amount when estimating probable future taxable profits against which deductible temporary differences are assessed for utilization. Furthermore, we did not notice any unintended consequences for non-financial assets measured at fair value when drafting the amendment to IAS 12. Further details of that analysis are included in staff paper 2 for this meeting. Consequently, we recommend to the Interpretations Committee that it should recommend to the ISB that the ISB should clarify the recognition of deferred tax assets for unrealized losses on debt instruments measured at fair value by an amendment to IAS 12, as included in staff paper 2A. And we want to ask the following three questions to the Interpretations Committee. What comments do the Interpretations Committee members have on the draft amendment to IAS 12 that is included in staff paper 2A? Do the Interpretations Committee members see any unintended consequences for the accounting for deferred tax related to non-financial assets measured at fair value from the proposed amendment to IAS 12? And finally, does the Interpretations Committee agree with the staff recommendation?
As I said before, I'm happy with the direction, I'm happy where it is going. I, however, do have comments on agenda paper 2A, but certain things that are not necessarily clear from reading both paragraph 29 and then the illustrative example. First of all, that paragraph 29A and 29B, I must say, is horrible to understand. And when you go to the example, you have a headache before you understand what it means. That being said, it's accurate. So, but I just wonder whether we could phrase a little bit better A and B, and in particular the nuances that is being introduced and that is new to many people, is that when you are reimbursed, when you get the reimbursement on the debts, this is an inflow that is considered taxable, but then you have a tax deduction that offsets it, and so you decomposed the two things. In the past, people never did that, and I understand this is what you're trying to hit at in paragraph 29A1. And if it is so, somehow I think it should be better phrased. No, on the example, to make it sure it works, I think there are some assumptions that are missing. The first one is page 8 in the general, when you say at the end of 2015, entity Z expects to file an ordinary tax loss of 100,000 for the year 2X20. How has been calculated this ordinary tax loss? Has it assumed the reversal of deferred tax liabilities, taxable temporary differences and deductible temporary differences? This is not specified. And as long as we don't know how this tax loss has been specified, you cannot, you don't know what the answer is. So you must specify how this tax loss has been calculated. Well, there are some numerical typos that I won't mention. But moreover, then I move on page 9, where you explain that application of paragraph 28-29, you must apply a two-step approach. The first one is you go at taxable temporary differences and you offset what you can, and then you see whether you have sufficient taxable profits. So you explain clearly this is the approach you have to do. However, your paper doesn't do that. Your paper goes straight into the second step without explaining why you don't do the first step. Well, at least in my reading. So it's confusing. And I believe also that type C deductible temporary differences you exclude, saying you won't be able to utilize, so you don't recognize deferred tax assets for this. I think you need an assumption to explain that you are not going to generate capital gains in 2016, 17, 18, 19, 20. At the moment, it's not stated in the paper. And finally, and again, I'm skipping typos, once I consider typos. When on page 10 and 11, you do the measurement of deferred tax assets and deferred tax liabilities, you apply a tax rate of 30% to all taxable temporary differences and utilization of deductible temporary differences. I understand what you're doing it. It's because you use, but you make an assumption that by using it and conducting it up until maturity, this makes you fall into the ordinary tax rate category rather than tax rate applicable on capital gains and losses. It's not obvious per se. So you need an explanation why it is 30% and not 10% that you pick up in that table. And finally, I would have liked on page 11 for allocation of changes in deferred tax assets between P&L and OCI a little bit more illustration with the numerical case. You just stop, say, do it. Applied to that case would have been a nice illustration.
Yeah, let's just work down the way here. Scott?
I agree with everything Laurent said, and just a couple of things I wanted to highlight that were causing me trouble. Describe the three investments as instruments of type A, type B, type C. It sounded to me like you were trying to say there were multiple type A instruments, multiple type B instruments, and multiple type C. That just seems to overcomplicate things. It leaves open the possibility that some of the type A could be valued above cost and some of them below cost, and then you wouldn't lump them all together in the analysis like you've done here. So I would have just said instrument A, instrument B, instrument C. So there's one instrument in each category. That way it avoids any of that possible complication. And then with respect to one of the things Laurence raised, I was having trouble we stick with the type A instrument, now this difference is going to turn, if unless something weird happens, over the next 5 years as the fair value moves back up towards cost as we get closer to maturity. Yet, you have assumed in your calculations in the example that the entire temporary difference turns in 2020. But that's not actually what's going to happen. So why are we doing the calculation as if the CU 100,000 tax loss in 2020 is calculated with the entire temporary difference turning in 20? Some of it would have turned in 16 through 19. Maybe what you're saying is that in 16 through 19, it turned, creating an NOL, a net operating loss carry forward, and that's what we then utilize in 2020. But it doesn't say any of that here, so I was left trying to figure out what have we done here, because if you take into account the entire temporary difference as if it turns in 2020, I think you're not actually reflecting the way somebody would have prepared the 2020 budget or the 2020 estimate at this point in time. These are all just getting the example to work and illustrate what we think it ought to illustrate. I do think this is exactly what's needed. It's all going in the right direction. And to Laurence's point about 29A Roman numeral 1 being particularly difficult to read, I thought it was as well. But then after I went through the example, I think that for those who are unclear as to what that paragraph says, I think it's the example that helps provide the clarity once we get the example reading right. So I don't know that I'd work too hard to change the language in 29A Roman numeral 1, although if somebody's got something to make it read easier, that'd be good.
Martin?
Yeah, I agree on the understanding of the wording that it is challenging, but probably that's also, well, IAS 12 is challenging overall. So therefore, I have to emphasize that I like the example. However, I guess we still have to optimize it a little bit. I had the same question mark on the 100,000. What does it mean in 2020? And I have on page number 5, which is basis for conclusion, number 17, an issue, because in B we say no deferred tax asset is recognized if the reversal of the deductible temporal differences will not lead to reductions in tax payments. However, I guess we say specifically this debt instrument is a non-tax event because it has no impact on tax payments. So that's what we say in BC4. So therefore, probably it's my understanding. I was confused.
Who did we reject?
Sorry?
At least that is a non-tax event was the review that we wanted to reject in the exam.
Yeah, you have a tax reduction when you get reimbursement at maturity. This yeah. is what is new in the thinking. Yeah.
Mm. Okay.
That nobody thought about. So in fact, you have a tax deduction.
Okay.
Andrew?
Very similar reactions to those who've already spoken. Just to draw out, I certainly agree that the basis for the 100,000 tax loss needs to be explained. I had the same question mark about why we're assuming that this entire deductible temporary difference reverses in year 5 when it's going to pull to par progressively, maybe not evenly, but progressively over the 5 years. I don't know why the example doesn't show the offset against the temporary, the taxable temporary differences first, yeah. before going to the next stage, which is the availability of suitable future taxable profits. Overall, I'd really like to see a far simpler example if possible, but I think there are actually a fairly small number of key points being made here about the existence of a deductible difference and then the basis on which you assess the recoverability of that deductible temporary difference. But the example is bringing out a lot of additional points beyond those which are core to the issue under discussion, is my reaction. Back on IAS 12 itself and the amendment to paragraph 29, just the sentence at the end talking about you assume if it's probable that you're going to recover an asset for more than its carrying amount. In this case, economically, I don't think we are recovering the asset for more than its carrying amount. We're simply holding the asset and the discount unwinds over the period, over the holding period. So from an economic point of view, we're not recovering any more than the carrying amount. And that sentence seems to be introducing a sort of piecemeal bit of guidance on the basis on which you estimate future taxable profits into IAS 12, when IAS 12 is generally silent on that. So it's to be going from a specific issue, to which that sentence isn't really relevant, to a general requirement on the basis for that future estimate. So I just question the necessity of that that sentence in particular.
Can I respond? I think this issue this issue arose based on the thinking you have on your balance sheet date. You have a lower fair value, and the thinking the issue that arose as part of the comment letter analysis on exposure draft was, so when I let's say I have only this debt instrument, nothing else, no other transactions, can I assume to recover the asset for the whole amount so that I can deduct my whole tax base, or do I need to assume when estimating probable future taxable profit that I can only recover it for the carrying amount? So I would not have something taxable profits beyond my carrying amount, and so there would not be anything I could offset the tax deductions represented by the deductible temporary difference against. And this was the issue what it arose from, and this was also the issue where the committee said we need to consult the board on whether we can do a clarification and analysis on that within the confines of the annual improvements process, or whether we need something broader, like a limited scope project. The committee then decided to consult the board on that. So it was, if you want, so one of the key issues for the limited scope project that we are now working on.
I think that there's no inconsistency in this example between the measurement and the future assumptions about future taxable profit, because both are simply allowing the discount rate to unwind.
This is absolutely true.
Sentence could be taken as an invitation to introduce an inconsistency between the measurement of the asset and the future projection of taxable profit.
Scott?
It is an invitation. When you have inventory on your books that you paid 100 for and you believe you're going to sell it for 110, you do indeed take into account that 10 as future profit. So I think it's telling you you are supposed to do that. Here the instrument has a fair value of 1,000,007, and we believe we're going to recover it for 2,000,000.
Yes.
And this says that's 300,000 in profit that you can, should, must factor into your estimate of future profit. So I think that is correct. I don't think this sentence needs to be added, because I think it's already obvious that that is the case, because we are forecasting future profits, right? That must mean we think we're going to sell our assets for more than they are on the books for, otherwise there's no profits. I would have left this notion only for the basis for conclusions, just sort of confirming that, you know, hey, when we expose this, somebody asked this question, but of course the standard already says you can go ahead and forecast that if that's what you believe will happen. So I think the sentence is correct. I
I would prefer to just leave it for the basis.
Luca, did you want to come in?
I share the Andrew comments. My main problem is with the last sentence of paragraph 29. I think that is creating more confusion that helps in order to clarify the issue. I think that is too general, and probably, or better, in my mind, seems to miss something, because we have to consider that we are creating a link between the single assets for which I'm creating the deductible temporary differences and the recoverability of these assets. That's not necessary is the only driver that you use when you verify the recoverability of your deferred tax assets. So that could be related also to the transformation of the reversal of deferred tax assets in a tax losses that you can recover in the future times with other incomes and deriving from other activities. So I think that is creating more confusion than benefits. Probably it's more appropriate for the specific case that we have analyzed, in which I see that when you have an available for sale securities with a fair value lower than its nominal amount, and you have the possibility to hold it until the end, there is something that you can do regarding the recoverability of the assets. But I struggle with the wording that is presented in the paper. The other problem that I have is when I see the breakdown of paragraph 29A in the two pieces, it seems to me that we are, I have two problems. The first one is one with the definition. Probably we have to work a little bit on this, because if we say that I have to consider the taxable profits excluding the effect of tax deduction, I'm not speaking about of a taxable profits. I'm speaking about something different, because my idea of taxable profit includes all the items that are included in the taxable profits and not excluding something. So I think that there is a definition problem. And the second is that paragraph 29, and it is written in the A parts, include also the cases in which, in the period in which there is the reversal, you have no enough income and you go in a loss, and in a taxable loss, and therefore you transform your deferred tax assets in something not more linked with the reversal, but in something that you have to verify according to the rules applied for the recoverable of losses. So it seems to me that we are missing something in the description.
Tony?
I share a lot of the comments that have gone before. I agree with the staff's analysis and the conclusion that the staff reaches. But I think I share everybody else's concern that the example is too complex, and it will be difficult for the uninitiated to understand it. And I wonder if we might take a step back and say, well, what question were we actually asked? And I think the question we were asked is, do you look at these instruments in isolation, or do you consider these instruments together with all of the other deductible temporary differences, taxable temporary differences, and so on? And I just wonder if we might focus the answer on the question we were asked. And I share a couple of other people's thoughts. I think it is self-evident in the standard. You have to assume the recovery of assets more than their carrying value. Otherwise, you would never be projecting any future profits. So I think that sentence is that other people have commented on is just redundant, and I'd be inclined to delete it. I also think it's evident that you have to forecast taxable profits before the reversal of deductible temporary differences. Otherwise, you would inevitably need twice as much future profit as you have deductible temporary differences to get them reversed. And again, I think that's confusing in the analysis, and I would just leave it out. And I practice in this area. I've never seen anybody forecast taxable profit for recoverability purposes, including the reversal of deductible differences. You just have to do it first, otherwise it doesn't work. And then I would leave out reference to tax planning and so forth. I would just assume that away, because it's detracting from the underlying principle, which is, do you look at these things in isolation? No, you don't. And can you assume that you're going to recover it for its face value? And I think if you did that, it would be a much simpler example that would illustrate the point we're trying to get across and the answer that I completely agree with. I just think that there's a risk that it's going to get lost in all of the detail that's in here.
Reinhardt?
My comments are very similar to the comments made by other committee members. With respect to the proposed amendments to IS 12, just a couple of additional thoughts. Referring to that sentence that a number of people have talked about, that last sentence in paragraph 29 about recovering an asset for more than its carrying value, I also agree that that sentence would be better placed, if at all, in the basis for conclusions or somewhere in the example, because besides the comments that others have made, I think inherently if you have a non-financial asset carried at fair value, that may not be a fair assumption to say you're going to cover it for more than its carrying value. So it just highlights the fact that, at least in my mind, that it might be better to not have that sentence in the paragraph but put it somewhere else. I agree with generally with what the staff proposals are, and I think it's helpful to try to clarify the distinction between taxable profit as used in paragraph 5 of IS 12 versus 24. The question I have is whether taxable profit is also used in the context of unused tax losses and unused tax credits, whether it's that term, taxable profit, is used in the same context as what we're thinking about in paragraph 29 or not, and whether there should be some clarification of that. And then just with respect to the example, besides the comments others have made, I think inherently the example, as Scott was saying, assumes that you do, for this financial asset, the AFS debt instrument, that you ignore things like future interest rate changes, because by definition, if future interest rate changes occur, the fair value will change. You'll have a different taxable or perhaps even a deductible temporary difference over its life. So it's just a static assumption, and assume you ignore everything else after that date and assume it just reverses on maturity. And that's inherently what this is saying. So those are my comments in conjunction with the others.
Sandy?
Yeah, I guess my comment was similar before. Someone said that, it's going to reverse over a period of time, and that's not necessarily true. It could get larger or it could get smaller over between the date of which this is done and I think it was 20, and it could flip. I actually think the example is a little too simplified, in the sense that I'm not certain that when you look at it and you say, okay, I have a security that has an unrealized loss, but I purchased it at a premium. Okay, that I'm not going to recover it for the expected carrying amount. So those are out of the ballpark immediately, right? And if I bought it at a discount, these all assume I purchased them at par. What if I purchased it at a discount and I have an unrealized loss on that? How do I treat that reversal of that deductible difference? It's the natural accretion. I mean, I guess I exclude it. I think the example's actually a little too simple, because in the premium scenario, you could have one where it is still at a premium even though it's at an unrealized loss, or it could be below par. So for me, I actually sort of stopped because I didn't see all the possible scenarios. And then I didn't like in paragraph in the agenda paper too, there's a paragraph that says, paragraph 27, it says, we understand entities assume in practice that they will recover many of their non-financial assets measured at fair value for more than their carrying amount, in particular if these assets are used in relation to profitable operations. But if I'm carrying them at fair value and they're at an unrealized loss, how is it that I make that assumption? And if I use that paragraph, if I believe I have that assumption, then even on a non-financial assets that an unrealized loss, it seems as though I'm saying I can record a deferred tax asset on it. Am I not understanding that right?
Thomas?
I think if you can only record a deferred tax asset on it if your tax base is higher than. So the fact alone that you have an asset measured at fair value and you expect to get more for it than the carrying amount does not give you a deferred tax asset. First of all, you need to have a tax base that is higher than the fair value at the balance sheet date. And I think
I read that paragraph that we've added and it sort of says that all I have to have is that expectation and I'm fine. Am I?
No, the paragraph. Yeah, this paragraph says probable, yeah.
That doesn't mean you're going to record it for tax asset. That's just
when you are estimating future profits. It says if you actually think there will be them, then estimate them. I mean, the recovery of an asset like this, a fixed income security at more than fair value, is very easy.
Yeah. No, but I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about a non-financial asset.
If you
sure.
Have, for
that's
example,
what,
a piece of plant equipment that had been impaired and was carried at fair value less cost to sell, you may have a deferred tax asset if the tax base, as Thomas says, is higher than the carrying value because you've written it down, and you would assume the recovery of that asset through the generation of future profits. And as Scott says, if those profits are probable, which is the threshold, then you would recognize the deferred tax asset.
But I have to assume that I'm using that equipment in a profitable...
Absolutely.
But
that's
in a situation where I don't have profits. I mean, that's why I'm asking the question in the first place, right?
But if you don't have profits, then you already answered the question. You're not predicting profits.
Okay. So I get to assume... Well, I have to think that through.
Reinhardt, and then let's try and wrap this up.
I agree with the point that Tony made. If you have an impaired asset and it's carried at fair value less cost to sell, but I was thinking about investment property at fair value. How can you assume you're going to recover it for more than its fair value? So it may not be a valid assumption in every circumstance. It's really my point.
I agree. Yeah. I agree completely.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Phelan?
Yes. I generally agree with the staff analysis and recommendation. It seems to me the staff paper is quite clear on the background status and concern rate. I just have one a comment on the bottom of page 9. Two last paragraphs seems contradictory. Tax rule classify interest income as ordinary, not as capital. So is the last paragraph really useful? On page 9.
Yeah, this is correct, yeah.
Okay. John?
Yeah, I mean, I agree overall with the staff proposals. I also agree with some of the comments that have been made by others. I think the example needs to illustrate the progression of the reversal over the life of the instruments, rather than the assumption that you've got this reversal at the end, because I think that adds to the confusion, or will add to the confusion in people's mind about the interaction with the tax, with the taxable profit in the final year. So I think you need to show the progression of the years. I also think you have to show the assessment of the recovery against the taxable temporary differences first, because that's the sequence that's required under paragraph 28 of the standard. In relation to the final sentence in the amendments to paragraph 29, I do think that's required, although it could be in the basis for conclusions, because that's a direct result of one of the issues raised in the comment letters, which was that the objective of IAS 12 seems to imply that when you recognize deferred tax, you should assume recovery of the of the assets and liabilities at their carrying amount. Now, I think that's in the objective, and it could be ignored, but I think that had added to some of the diversity in practice, and therefore I think that clarification is needed, and it's not redundant. Those are my comments.
Julie?
I don't have anything to add, thanks.
Okay. All right, what I hear is, I think, general support for the analysis, but the baby's ugly. That the example, my sense from the committee is that the example is in some cases over-engineered, in other cases under-engineered. But the basic message, I didn't hear anybody objecting to. So obviously the example has to be re-engineered. I'd like, let's try something here. I would like to ask Thomas to circulate a revised example to committee members and ask you to respond directly to him and not to one another, because if we had you responding to one another, we'd be conducting a meeting outside of Sunshine, and we can't do that. But I don't want to have a repeat of this experience. And from the number of people who focused on the example in very great detail, you've obviously given it a lot of thought. So can everybody agree that's a reasonable way to proceed? As I say, I need to ask you not to correspond with one another, because that would violate our open meetings policy. But I think this is really no different than me asking three or four of you to work with Thomas. I'm just asking all of you to work with Thomas.
If you engineer the example, would it make sense to add something about minimum taxation restriction? We have, I mean, the topic we discussed last time, which is still open, but I mean, for sure it would be helpful if we had something in an example, if we go to, say, open with an amendment, IRS 12 anyhow, to include it into one example. Because we have already here different kinds of taxes, capital and income, whatever. Would it make sense, or would you exclude it just as an idea?
I would recommend that we don't add another point of principle to illustrate here. You're right, we've got this other issue. I'd suggest that we continue to progress that one separately from this.
I think Tony gave us a piece of advice that we ought to have written down and recite to ourselves before every meeting. What was the question we were asked? And sometimes we tend to drift away from that. Okay, that's what we'll do.
So, just for clarity, apart from re-engineering the example, we have a recommendation for the board. Then. Is correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, that was so much fun. We'll try again. Paper three.
Yes, the second issue on income taxes. The committee received a request to clarify the accounting for deferred tax in the consolidated financial statements of the parent when the subsidiary has only one single asset within it. We call this the asset inside.